Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Place the Conversation. Today, we're making place for a conversation about worship. And one of the things that our guest, Christopher Wells, and I have been working on for the past probably close to 5 years is a book called A Community at Worship. And in that book, we talk about helping congregations embrace their unique theology, culture, and practice of worship. And we thought it might be interesting to just spend a few minutes talking about the genesis of the book. You know, why write another book about worship, and then some of the ideas and some of the principles that are there. And so today I'm joined by Chris Wells, and again by my good friend Nick Everhart. So Chris, why don't you spend a few minutes and just talk about the idea behind the book, maybe a little bit about how it came to be, and that'll get our conversation started.
Great, yeah, thanks for having me. I think this is gonna be fun. Let me credential myself a little bit. I have led worship in one context or another since I was 13 years old. So I grew up in the church. My parents wanted me to learn how to play music. That was very important to them. It eventually became important to me, but wasn't really until I got to high school at least. And, you know, one of the things that happens when you take organ lessons is that you take those organ lessons from a preacher's wife, usually, is how it goes. And sure enough, Marge Hines taught me to play the organ. And wonderful lady. I learned a lot from her. And if you learn to play the organ, then suddenly there's this opportunity to be a summer organist at a variety of churches, at least in the small town that I grew up in. So, you know, folks would say, hey, is the Wells kid available? Because our organist is going on vacation, you know, this Sunday in July. And so I sort of got thrown into the deep end when I was a young kid. Never forget my first ever time leading a hymn. I had practiced all week, super nervous. I didn't realize that the hymn had a chorus, and I had just been practicing the verses. So I had to sight read it live first thing on a Sunday morning. And I'd love to say that every worship experience since then has been much more streamlined, but you know, things happen with live music and live worship in particular. So I've been doing this a long time. I'm not a professional by any means. I have a day job, but worship has become it's a passion of mine, I would say. And some of the best experiences and the best relationships I've had in my life have been centered around it. So that's the preamble, and it sort of sets up why did we write this book. So I, like a lot of folks who came up leading worship through the mid-90s and early 2000s and even through today, there's some people that'll tell you that the worship wars are over, and I don't believe they're over. I think there are still churches out there that are battling about worship and how they worship and why they worship. And I think until we figure out how to answer a few fundamental questions, that will always be the case, because there's always going to be, there are always cultural trends. There are always folks who are going to think that the church is theirs because they've been there for a while and they've invested a lot of time and money in it. And one of the things we have to get used to is that all the things we do on Sundays and Wednesdays or whenever it is that you gather as a community, it's none of it belongs to you. So I spent a lot of time in my youth wrestling with questions of, why, when we plan a church service, why do we choose these songs? Why not these other songs? Why do we have these instruments and not these other instruments? And I had no good answers for them. And, that stayed with me leading worship in high school through occasionally leading worship in college. And then I got to a church. I lived in Baltimore for 5 years with my wife and family when I was doing my doctorate, and worship there. And the same things that I had seen as a kid in high school and in college, they were there in this church in Baltimore, a very different community from what I grew up in. And it was all a lot of frustration about why are we doing things the way we're doing? And so I was the new guy on the block, right? I showed up at church, the pianist had, you know, sort of taken time off and they asked me to play. And so I played what I knew how to play, and that was different from what they were used to. That created a lot of angst and a lot of frustration. And eventually that church closed. It turned out their underlying issues were not, we don't like these songs. It was actually just pure racism. They didn't like that the community was changing around them. And so anything different was off limits because it signaled something else to them. So then I came to First Baptist, and I love this community, and I've had the opportunity to work with some amazing musicians and worshipers here, and I've had the opportunity to build the worship team here. But again, the same things when I started. Well, this guy's different, he's doing different things, he's teaching these young guys and gals to play different instruments, we don't like these songs. And so I reached a real crisis point probably about 6 years ago. I was gonna quit, and I told Dan, pastor at the time, I was like, I don't wanna do this anymore. We're not making progress, we're focused on the wrong things. Like, that was too loud, this was the wrong song, I don't wanna do that reading, I wanna do this reading. And I found myself asking a question that I had never once asked. And at this point, I'm 20 years in to leading worship. God, how did you evaluate our worship this Sunday? Did we do the things that bring joy to you? Was it honoring to you? Did you get what you wanted from it? And I realized that for 20 plus years, I'd been evaluating worship the wrong way, based on what I liked and what I thought fit and what I thought was the best way to do things. And so it was like a Christmas break. I was at my in-law's house. There was a lot of downtime. And so I got real deep into the scriptures. I spent time listening to God rather than trying to tell him what I thought was right. And came away with a document that I called Our Theology of Worship for this community. And it was my answer to what is God's view of worship in our context, because I really was focused on, can we get this right here? I wasn't thinking, you know, this is not some broad, every church should adopt this, anything like that. It was more about, can we get this right here in our context? And that was sort of the genesis of the idea.
Good. And so how did it go? You know, so let's talk a little bit about, you know, that was the genesis, that was the, you know, the idea that we needed to be thinking differently about worship. And honestly, you know, when you came to me, you came back from that time away and said, hey, I want to share this with you. What do you think about this?
Yep.
You know, is this something that you think we could do here? You know, I looked at it and I thought, wow, okay, I've never thought about worship this way. Yeah. I mean, this is a totally different way to think about worship. Yeah. And that's an extremely healthy way to think about worship. And you know, you and I went through it and spent a lot of time, you know, working it over and everything. And so talk about that process and talk about what it looked like to introduce that to the church. And talk about some of the buckets. We talk about worship norms, so talk about what that looks like.
Yeah, the language in the book, and this was actually one of the last concepts in the book, was that, you know, as we were writing it, one of the last concepts that we sort of came up with, it was, we kept saying theology, culture, and practice, and it's a mouthful, right? And so we need one concise way to capture what this means to a church. So we came up with worship norms. This is what defines normal in your context of worship. And the three buckets of norms are practice, which are the things we do, right? Like, what does the sanctuary look like? Are there bulletins? Where does the offering go? Who plays what, when? Who plans the service? That's the stuff we fight about, right? That's the stuff that in my experience has been the most contentious. Because you don't have the grounding in the things that tell you why you do that stuff. So for example, early on in my time here, one of the first things I did to the bulletin was I moved the invocation to after the call to worship. And that's because invocation means to call in. It is a prayer to call the Spirit into worship. And if you do it somewhere in the middle of worship, you're doing it wrong, right? And that's an element of culture, right? You got used to putting the invocation somewhere else. It wasn't meaningful where it was. And so that culture had informed a practice that didn't make much sense. And culture's you know, cultures is a little bit, it's kind of a squishy concept, right? So we often think of culture in our churches, at least in churches I've been in, as the traditions, the things that we've done for a long time. But, you know, there are a lot of churches out there that might be, you know, sort of bilingual or multicultural communities. And so then culture has a lot to do with demographics. It has a lot to do with the paths that folks have taken. I think First Baptist actually is in some ways very mixed in that there are, you know, there are sort of blue collar demographics and there are white collar demographics in that church. And that's been true for a long time. And while we don't often think about those things because they're a little less tangible, they have a large effect on the what that we do when we gather. And then beyond all that, the stuff that really should, if you think of this as a pyramid with, you know, the food pyramid with, you know, the stuff on the top that you shouldn't eat that much of or care that much about, practice, culture in the middle, and then the foundation should be your theology. Like, if your theology is that, you know, the Bible should be an important part of worship every Sunday, which is something I think that you is very biblically founded. It's not in our theology, by the way, but something you could have there. Then your culture should reflect that, right? The Bible should be prominent. It should be a part of our traditions, and that should inform, like, this is what we do on a Sunday. We're going to read this much. It's incontrovertible that we will always have the Bible as a part of our worship services. So I think we've been, as a church, we've been eating a lot of junk food spiritually in terms of worship. We've been focused on the minutia because it's easy to focus on. And there's also a lot of expediency, right? Like the pastor goes from one service, close the hymnal, close the Bible, and then you're on to planning the next one. And so that urgency doesn't create a lot of space for thinking deeply about these things. But one of these days, and I'm saying this to all my millennial counterparts out there, one of these days, a kid's going to walk into church and he doesn't know how to play the guitar, but he has a laptop with Ableton on it and, you know, a set of turntables, and that person wants to help you worship. And he doesn't know Hillsong, right? He knows whatever else. Maybe it's stuff that he or she has written. We're going to keep fighting these battles about what is right in worship and what is not until we focus on what God really thinks worship should be. Yeah. So figuring out, like, writing this document down, right, that didn't change worship at First Baptist overnight, but it created the right set of buckets to have those conversations, and it created a vocabulary that helped us to understand one another as we came to each other with concerns or desires and whatever else.
Yeah, and I think that was the healthiest thing, right, is that as we worked through that, and then as we taught it to the elders and deacons, and then as they said, yeah, we adopt this. We think this is the correct way to be thinking about worship. And then as we taught it to the congregation, it gave us a framework to be able to have conversations about worship that moved away from the easy conversations that people have all the time. And the easy conversations are, well, I like this, I don't like that. Right. You know, this is my personal preference, and I don't want that. And so when are you going to sing my hymns? When are you going to stop doing these songs? And it gave us a framework to be able to have the right kind of conversations. There was one conversation that I had that just really crystallized this for me. We got done with worship one Sunday. And as the service was over and I was moving through the sanctuary, somebody came up to me and said, well, that service was an absolute disaster. And, you know, and I kind of looked at him and I said, wow, okay. You know, help me unpack that. What do you mean by the fact it was an absolute disaster? Well, the worship was just terrible. And we had gone through and we had had all of our worship slogans and we had taught those. And historically in the past, you know, somebody would have said that to me and I would have owned that. And I would have said,
yeah, you bristle, right?
I would have bristled, got very anxious, angry, would have fought back, would have said something probably less than gracious, would have gone home and said, man, what a failure you are. You can't even put together a service that's meaningful to people. Yeah. But instead, the two of us stood there and we had a conversation. And I said, well, help me unpack this. Let's walk through our different slogans. And you know, our, one of our slogans is our worship is about Jesus. It's like, okay, was our worship about Jesus? Well, yes, it was. I said, okay, you know, worship is work. You know, did people work at worship? Well, yes, the praise team worked really hard. They really, really work hard all the time to lead us in worship. Okay, that's fantastic. And we, I ticked through a few more. And then one of them is sing unto the Lord a new song. And I said, okay, well, how about this one? Sing unto the Lord a new song. And they go, well, yeah, that's it. That's the problem. You know, you sang that new song, which I can't stand. Yeah. And as soon as you sang that new song, I stopped worshiping. Yeah. And their face just stopped. As soon as they said it, they stopped. It was almost comical watching somebody freeze. And actually, you could see their mind thinking. And they stopped and they said, oh, my gosh, I stopped working at worship once we sang that song.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, I don't know about that. And they said, oh, what I did. And I said, well, you know, they said, the problem was me. The problem was me. I stopped working at worship once we sang that song.
Right.
And I just kind of chuckled and I said, well, look, I don't want to, you know, tell you that you're the problem, but it seems to me that we hit all the buckets in the worship service. And they said, yeah, you know, you really did. And I stopped working and I need to work harder. And I said, well, if that's what you feel, that's kind of, I'm not going to argue with you about that.
Yeah.
And it just changed the way that, that's just one example of how it changed the way that we were able to have conversations about worship, in churches.
Yeah. And, I'm interested in Nick's take on this, given that he's, you've been in the church a little longer than I have, and you've seen massive changes in the way church is done, and I wonder if any of this resonates. I'm curious.
Well, it does. I sort of have mixed feelings about it.
Yeah.
Because what you're saying makes sense to me.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there's certain liturgy, way of worshiping that I grew up with.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And in my mind, well, that's the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess at one time I was having a discussion with someone about the music, and they said, well, they didn't like the music. And someone had said to me, well, you don't go to church to be entertained. You go to church to worship God, and you shouldn't be focusing so much on the music.
Yeah.
And I also know one of my brothers is a Presbyterian minister, and he told me the biggest source of dissent and conflict in the church is the music program.
Yeah.
And not just his church, but every church.
Yeah.
And so, I just have to say that the reason that I don't come here is not because the worship service is different than it used to be.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's good to know.
And I think the one of the things that I found myself thinking, right? And one of the reasons that we did the work to write the book was that I found myself saying, if I could go back over 30 plus years of ministry, like to all the churches that I was a part of, like this is the thing that I would go back and take to them. This is the truth. This is the stuff that I've learned later in life that I wish that I had in my toolbox when I showed up at the first church I was at.
Yeah.
You know, at the second church I was at, the third church I was at, you know, like this is the stuff that I wish I was thinking this way. Because I think it's incredibly healthy, because it talks about, rather than telling a faith community that you have to worship this way and that you have to use these instruments and that you have to sing these songs and that your service has to look a certain way, what it works at is helping the congregation be able to discern what their unique worship norms are and being able to say, look, celebrate them, live into them, and that's when you're going to experience renewal that's when you're going to experience growth as a community,
right?
Rather than trying to, you know, look around the community around you and say, oh, well, that church is bigger than our church, so if we worship like
we
them,
do what they do.
If we yeah. just do what they do, well, then we would grow. And yeah. nothing could be further from the truth.
It's cargo cult thinking.
Yeah, yeah, because you don't have the same people, you don't have the same skill sets, you don't have the no. same resources. Yeah. You know, discern the Spirit's invitation for your community, and then and celebrate your congregation's, unique yep. Worship norms and live into them.
Churches are a community of people, right? And there's going to be conflict in communities of people, and yeah. that. Not only is that okay, that should be expected, we should be ready for it. This book that we wrote, it's really a blank template. Like there are spaces, you know, it's like Mad Libs. There are spaces for you to fill things in
yeah.
after carefully discerning them as a team from your church. But one of the biggest benefits that it creates for you is that it forces you to fight about the right thing, right? Yeah. Like, again, talking about that church that we went to in Baltimore, we had cultural problems. The wrong people, quote unquote, were playing the instruments. The wrong people lived in the community outside the doors of the church, quote unquote. If you put things in the right buckets, then you can have those discussions rather than, I'm upset because the worship is different than it used to be. I don't know why that's that important, but gosh darn it, I'm angry. And you never address the real issue. And like I said, that church folded.
Yeah.
Because it didn't.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. yeah.
Well, so I know for a fact that there are people who don't come here to worship anymore because they don't like the music.
Yeah.
How do you include their needs?
It's an interesting question.
I mean, I know you can have a blended service, I guess.
Yeah.
But does that work?
So I don't want this to sound harsh, but if we're worshiping well, I don't care about their needs. And again, I don't want that to be dismissive, but like we're all supposed, one of my favorite scriptures is it's either Exodus or Deuteronomy. It's writing all this stuff about the law of what you can do with pigs and donkeys and all that stuff. And God says, no one should come before me empty handed. And I think for decades, people came and they didn't have to try very hard to worship because they knew all the songs and everything was very familiar. And you don't even have to look at the bulletin because you know the order, right? Like there are no surprises. And I think worship is it's a muscle group in our spirit. And if you don't work on it, it gets flabby. And so I would say to those people, if you're not part of a worship community that's challenging you, now I can understand, like if it changes overnight and there are things that worship teams do that make this hard, right? Like the lyrics aren't keeping up with the songs that are being played. The scripture is in the wrong translation from what's actually in the bulletin. It's confusing what the pastor's doing. There are things that we can do to shoot ourselves in the foot. But if that stuff is in place and the theology is in place and everything you're doing is consistent with it, then the problem, like Pastor Dan pointed to, the problem is you. And you have to decide, do I want to find a place where it's easy to worship, or do I want to be a part of community that's going to stretch me as a worshiper? And so, again, you know, I hope those people can find a place where that's true and they're comfortable, but that comfort is not the goal.
Well, sort of like what you're saying is you can't please everyone.
You can't please everyone. One of the most interesting things about, so we do a lot of what people might call contemporary worship. I went back through, I wrote some Python scripts, and I scrubbed all of our orders of worship for the last, going back to 2016, I think, and 48% of the songs that we do, not on a given Sunday, because some Sundays it's all going to be stuff from the last 5 years. Sometimes, some Sundays, it might be stuff from the first, the first millennia. 48% of all the songs we do are hymns, and that's because those songs are consistent with our theology of worship, and they express something. Some of those hymns are not familiar. We've had to take hymns and teach them, right? Even though they're in the red book in the hymnals, people don't know them. And there are certain hymns that I just won't do. In the Garden has no content, and I will not sing that song. It's a love song to Jesus. It's very nice. If you want to sing it in the shower, it's good, but it's not a good worship song.
I love that song.
I know. I'm sure you do. Go read the lyrics afterwards. It may as well be a Taylor Swift song.
So, and I think the... you know, the idea about blended worship. Like, I think that was one of the, it's a very damaging idea, right? To be able to sit there and say, hey, in service on this Sunday, we're going to have blended worship, which means we have to have two hymns and three praise songs. And, you know, and it's like, because then people are sitting there keeping count.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
it just exacerbates the focus on the wrong thing.
It does. It does. And so blended worship, you know, as Chris and I would talk about it, was no, if you attend worship over the course of a year, you're going to experience blended worship. You're going to experience some Sundays that are nothing but hymns. You're going to experience some Sundays that are nothing but praise and worship songs. But it's all going to be driven out of our worship norms. And every Sunday is going to be shaped by what it is that we're trying to accomplish that Sunday.
Yeah.
And the worship norms guide the service. And there's no song that is, you know, that is outside of what we could use to help lead worship if it accomplishes, if it fits into, you know, into that theology, culture, and practice of worship. You know, so much so that, you know, we have, you know, sung U2 on a couple of occasions.
Coldplay. Stuff we've written as a team.
Yeah.
You know, it's never going to be on K-Love, but it expressed something meaningful about our community in that moment.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, right? That's the piece that's important.
No, and two things I wanted to highlight there. One, it's important to get this vocabulary right. Like, you mentioned two things there, which are, one, worship is not just what you sing. And a lot of people, worship is the music, and there's a direct mapping between the two, and worship is a lot more. In fact, one of the cultural elements of every church I've ever been in is that, you know, if you're not singing, you're not worshiping. And so part of the reason folks don't like it when a worship team does new songs is that because they can't do it, and they don't realize that just speaking the words, right? Even if you can't keep up with the melody, just speaking the words, bowing your head in silent prayer while the song's happening, that's an act of worship.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, hymn is a very fuzzy term.
Yeah.
It means a song of devotion to a deity. It's not even necessarily the deity that I identify as mine. And you ask two people in a church if a song is a hymn or not, and one will check one hymnal and one will check another. Again, these conversations are really important for unpacking, like, what do you mean when you say this? How do you decide that this is right and that's wrong? And a lot of that is just, we haven't evaluated how we think about these things in a long time. And my final thought there is that one of the aspects of this worship norms that we ask churches to come up with is, they're living documents, right? Your theology shouldn't change all that often, but it may. Your culture's going to change, you know, the factory in town goes out of business, right? Some people are going to move on, or a new population comes in because they've been displaced for some reason. Your community is going to change, and that's going to change your culture. And then look, your practices, they should probably change pretty frequently.
Yeah.
New technologies, you know, new people with new skill sets. So hold on to them. Hold on to the things loosely that you don't have to hold on to tightly.
Yeah, your thought about, you know, worship is not just music. It's some of the most profound and deepest worship I've ever experienced has been, you know, with some of the Jesuit communities.
Mm.
You know, when I go spend a week with the Jesuits, and their communities are silent.
They're silent.
There's nothing. I mean, it's just silent. And that's, you know, spend an hour every other day with a spiritual director. And the rest of it is intentional silence inside community, sharing meals together and everything. But the meals are silent. I mean, there's just no conversation, no anything. But, you know, if you would ask me, hey, rate your 5-6 best worship experiences, you know, they would constantly come, you know, in a lifetime. They would be at the top. And so there's, we have a lot of work to do.
That's interesting. In a Quaker meeting, there's very little talk. And I once went to a Spanish-speaking church in the mountains of New Mexico. I had no idea what they were saying, and it was very moving service to me.
That's it, right?
Yeah, yes. God doesn't need our words.
Yeah.
He doesn't need them.
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? Like, yeah, that's just it. Well, hey, listen, the book is called A Community at Worship. It's available on Amazon. There'll be a link provided as part of the podcast here. And
all proceeds go to the nonprofit, by
yes,
the way.
That's right. All proceeds go to a place in the conversation. And they get used to help congregations grow and their ability to discern their unique worship norms and to help us grow as a community of worship. And so, yeah, Chris, thank you for joining us and talking to us about this. And Nick, thank you for your questions.
Thank you, Chris.
You're very welcome.
It's always good, good to be together. And just no matter where you are, whether you are joining a community of faith in a congregation, in a church, whether you're sitting in your living room watching a service on TV, whether you're out walking the fields or whatever, wherever you happen to be, may you always be aware of the Spirit of God alive and well and at work in your world.
Amen.